Hello and welcome to the Ride AI podcast. I'm your host, Ed Niedermeyer. As I began developing this podcast, one of the main goals was to really start to reframe some of the conversations that have been happening for the last 10 years or so of around new mobility technologies. It's been very clear for a while that, you know, the cycle of hype and disillusionment is something that can only go on for so long. And as our very first episode discussed with Mike Ramsey of Gartner, you know, at some point we have to move towards a slope of enlightenment. This view was really clarified for me when I was recently asked to have a conversation about driving automation technology for a group of transit agencies in the state of Washington. And my initial pitches all kind of bounced off them because they were sort of this reaction of, you know, we've kind of heard this all before. And I said, well, what if we do something totally different? What if we have someone come that I can have a conversation with who has been there in the first wave of AV startups that didn't work out, learned some really important lessons, is back with a whole new kind of company in the broader, you know, automation, driving automation space. And we can talk about some of those lessons. And for an audience that I was assured was not interested in hearing about driving automation tech, it went over really, really well. We ended up speaking for hours. So I had to, in launching this podcast, I had to have him back. And so I'm thrilled to be once again sitting down with Stefan Salz-Oxmacher. He is formerly the founder of Starsky Robotics, currently the founder and CEO of Polymath Robotics. Stefan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ed.
Yeah. So we've known each other for a while. We've attended Autonicast parties together for a while.
It starts to become upsetting when you realize how long you've known people. I feel like we're now at the point where it's like, oh crap, it's been like 8 years.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly, you know, why it's, I think, so important to kind of stop and kind of look back at the last.
I thought we'd
have
full autonomy by like the second year we knew each other.
Right, because when we first met, you were in the self-driving truck business. Tell us about Starsky.
Yeah, so Starsky Robotics was an early self-driving truck company. We were super full stack. We were going to drive every truck at some point in time in the future, make hundreds of trillions of dollars imminently by basically doing teleop in the truck yard, autonomy on the highway, and then being the trucking company so we could pick our battles to find the world's easiest routes to roll out first on. And that seemed pretty feasible, and it was still really hard, and it turned out to be just a little bit too hard.
And for perspective, I mean, because now I feel like autonomous trucking is something that people are more familiar with. Even a couple years ago, there was sort of a big bubble in that, or there was sort of a lot of excitement around that. But this is before. Give us a time frame of what you're talking about.
So I started working on that idea in 2015. I remember talking with other folks like Anthony Lewandowski while they were still working at Google. And they're like, well, why do you even want to work on trucks? If you can use teleop, like, why don't you just do like taxi cabs? Like, oh, because like trucks are a real industry.
Yeah.
And then like other people started working on trucks too.
Yep. So and you had vehicles on the road in Florida, right? Because the legal environment there allowed you to do it. Yep. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Thanks to former state senator Jeff Brandis down in Florida. It's actually like one of my favorite little quips about that whole era is in the 2016 to 2020 autonomy era, you'd hear a lot of people explain it away by saying, hey, the tech's ready, but regulation isn't there at all. Jeff Brandis in Florida made it legal to drive a vehicle on public roads with no person in it as early as like 2012. So for much of Starsky's history, we did almost all of our meaningful tests in Florida, and in 2019, we actually drove on a live highway just south of Orlando with no person in the vehicle at all.
And you guys were like delivering actual goods.
Yep, we were hauling freight. We had a mixed fleet of regular trucks and autonomous trucks. In total, we were doing like $6 or $7 million a year of business hauling freight for people who, given the name of the company, assumed that every truck was autonomous and driver out.
Yep. So today, there's obviously, you know, fewer self-driving truck companies than there were back then, including Starsky, but not only, right? There have been others that have come and gone. I think really Aurora and Kodiak are kind of the last two folks that are really...
So I think Plus is still puttering around.
Yep.
Einride.
Einride, yep.
Still theoretically exists.
Yep.
Though what they do has changed a couple of times. to the point where I'm not entirely sure what they do or don't do these days. So yeah, there's a couple people like puttering around, but I don't know.
Yeah. Where did Starsky get into trouble? What were the challenges there?
Yeah, so I mean, I think a real thing with robotics in general, and I started Starsky because I knew about the problem in trucking, that there's a persistent labor shortage. You just can't hire people who are willing to spend a month at a time on the road. And I thought, like, hey, you can't get people to be truck drivers, but people in like Reno can fly drones in Afghanistan. So like, if you made trucks remote control, you probably would no longer have a labor shortage. And that was about the level that I was able to think about that problem set at. And that seemed pretty feasible. And as I dug in, it just turned out that robots as a broad field are really freaking hard. And Starsky kind of kept on adapting its strategy as we learned just how hard the problem was to make it still be feasible. What a lot of the rest of the market did is just kind of say, like, you know, Moore's Law is a thing. It's going to get better. We're going to collect a bunch of data. The machine learning is going to do its trick. And sooner or later, we're going to be able to drive everywhere. And Starsky, like, I think, like, the ultimate downfall of Starsky is we spent the last 2 years of the company just working on getting the driver out of the truck on a public highway, building a autonomy-ready trucking business where we thought we could immediately deploy self-driving trucks. Went to go to the fundraising market. The fundraising market was kind of like, but, like, none of that's that hard, right? Like, these other guys say they have a lot of data.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure data is the hard part.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a fascinating point, right? Which is that, like, compared to the other companies out there, your pitch was, and I love both of your companies are called robotics. And I feel like this, you're sort of grounded in some of the tough realities of robotics, right? And so you were saying, we're just going to automate this one piece of it. We're not going to boil the ocean, right? We're not doing all of this. We're going to do this in a focused way. And the venture capital response to that was, yeah, but other people are going to, like, come up with a general solution.
A particularly painful quip I remember is, you know, at Starsky, the whole thought process was, how can we limit the problem to make it, like, easy for V1? So, like, for example, it's really, like, it is mostly an open problem, how to drive autonomously on a public road in snow at highway speeds. So we're just going to drive places where it almost never snows. And if it happens to snow in Florida, we're going to pull the trucks over until the snow melts. And, like, you know, to start off with, maybe for the first year or two, we're just going to drive during the day. Because, you know, a lot of day is, you know, half of the time. We can make plenty of money and drive in the day. And I remember a VC saying, yeah, but, you know, your competitors are saying that they're going to be able to drive at night and in snow. And I feel like you're going to lose a lot of market share if they can drive at night and you can't.
And in a way, we're still seeing, not to get sidetracked, but we still see a little bit of this problem, I think, like, in the here and now with, I feel like Tesla is emblematic of this, right? Of, like, you know, you have Waymo spending, you know, burning billions of dollars a year using this really, like, complex, you know, sophisticated solutions to have a robotaxi service. And yet Tesla can still somehow have any credibility at all when they say, oh, we're going to have, like, robotaxis with, you know, $300 worth of cameras.
I think, like, there's, if you pitch, like, a new version of DocuSign, people ground themselves in reality pretty quickly. They're like, oh, well, like, why is this DocuSign better than the old one? And, like, how are you going to grab market share for DocuSign? And is it really possible for you to move signature files around that way? And when you start talking about things that look like the future, like robots, all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Well, your vision of reality seems cooler than their vision of reality. So that sounds neat.
Yeah. Well, and like Silicon Valley, traditionally, like, a lot of robotics has happened outside of Silicon Valley, right? Like MIT, Carnegie Mellon, these other places. Do you think this has something to do with, like, right? Cause, like, as a venture capitalist, you want a platform, right? And so if you, like, think of, like, the car as a platform, and, oh, you make that self-driving, like, they're swinging for the fences, right? Like venture capitalists don't typically, or they haven't typically in the past, wanted to do these limited things, and typically robotics that work tend to be limited things, not general purpose platforms.
I mean, there's a great quip that, like, what do you call a robot that that works? A machine.
Right. Totally.
Which I'm not even the first person to say this week, let alone ever. But yes, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the for a lot of the technologies that have been the most successful, it's a, oh, cool. If you can make this limited set of assumptions work, if you can make it so you can find me a relevant website with a couple of words written into a field, cool. Let's put a lot of money into that and that'll be exciting. And I think there's just been kind of this, like, cognitive failure when it comes to investing in frontier tech, where it just becomes like, okay, cool. You said that your version of the future, it needs 25 miracles. Someone else says it only needs 4 miracles. But like the world with 25 miracles is better. So I'd rather put money into that.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. No. Okay. And so obviously you've been able to get another company funded. So I obviously there are ways around this problem and I want to get to that. But first let's, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about you is that when Skarsky did fail, you know, you wrote a blog post about it and you like shared lessons about it, which I really wish more people in the space would do. But one of the things that you specifically sort of identified on the technical side, you alluded to this earlier, is overconfidence in machine learning. Talk a little bit about sort of the role you see that playing in that first wave of AV.
Yeah, I mean, hype. I think there was a general, and I think this, to be frank, I think this problem is now more generalized. It hasn't gone away. I think like it's funny. I think we're seeing the same thing happen right now with what is currently being called AI,
right?
Which I think we will not call AI in 4 years,
right? But so you're talking about generative and large learning models,
yes. Yeah. Like with LLMs of the moment, we currently have this moment where it's good and it's getting better and it's going to keep on getting better infinitely until it's AGI, and everyone was doing the same thing with machine learning in robotics and autonomy 5-6 years ago, of like if I collect enough data. If I collect enough mapping with LiDAR point clouds and I see enough things happen on the road, eventually I will have an AGI driver that can go anywhere. And that just hasn't happened.
And it's that G part, right? It's the general part that it's both the...
There have been like amazing systems that have layered a lot of work and a lot of rules on top. Like kind of like every time there's a new workaround for ChatGPT to get it to tell you how to make napalm or how to spread anthrax in an aerosolized form. Every time someone figures out how to get OpenAI to answer those questions, they basically hard code a rule set to stop that from happening again. And like a lot of those rule sets on top of these broad systems can turn into a robotaxi in San Francisco with an incredible amount of money. But does that robotaxi then work in Mumbai? Does that robotaxi then work in Belo Horizonte? And so far, the answer seems to be no.
Right. And so yeah, you make a really great point, which is that like the and really like at this point in robotaxis, there's really only one company that you can say is successful at the moment.
Depends on if successful means robots driving with no people in them or, you know, self-sustainable business.
Right. Right. Well, by the standards of the space,
yes,
right? Which unfortunately, you know, includes
things
that I consider fraudulent, like what Tesla's doing, right? So it's a big space. It's
by
diverse.
By the standards of fifth grade, I was Casanova.
Yeah.
More than one girl would talk to me on occasion.
Right. So, but conceptually though, like, you know, again, like it's the approach of sort of using these probabilistic systems, not as like this general one size, you know, one algorithm to rule them all kind of, you know, solution. But as you say, L4, like limited domain, right? Like, huge sensor set and creating like an architecture around these probabilistic systems. That's what allows you to get to like safety critical levels of reliability.
And that's what
right?
the innards of a lot of these programs have looked like.
Yeah.
There's just been a weird disconnect between those innards on the engineering side and like the bozos on the business side. And I think this is a useful time to call that I technically am, you know, a bozo on the business side. but like I've not to say anything identifying. I was talking to the business side of a robotaxi fleet once in 2020, where one of the senior business people was like, you know, I tell these engineers it's okay that we can only drive in these conditions right now, but in 6 months we have to be able to drive anywhere in the world in any condition. And like we're talking, you know, SVP of a multi-thousand person organization in charge of go-to-market.
Yeah. I mean, right, like there's a part of Silicon Valley culture that is just, you can't ever beat that all the way out of, right? You're a really optimistic guy too. You have to be a founder of a startup company. Like, and yet like there's no way to kind of limit that.
I think there's just something with robots. I don't know.
It's just robots in particular.
I think there's just something with robots where people get real dumb.
Yeah.
And AI as well, like broader AI stuff. I think people just get real dumb about it.
Yep. And how many, right? There's like a number of humanoid AI robots now that are getting funding. But like that's
pretty soon it'll be a humanoid having a conversation with a humanoid in front of two microphones like we are right now. It's gonna be great.
Is that interest in sort of
humanoids are robotaxis in 2016?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Like I don't know who they are, but I'm sure right now there's an Ed Niedermeyer somewhere who's writing rage bait tweets about how agility or figure or X1 or whatever are completely full of shit. And somewhere there's Stefan who's like, I'm going to build a humanoid that won't look cool, but could be usable.
Yeah.
And those two people in 8 years will be having a debrief on what went wrong in the humanoid space.
Yeah. But it proved, and it's fascinating to me that, like, you know, and again, this is not to say there aren't some use cases for humanoid.
Totally.
It's just that that's not where the funding's going to them. The funding's going to them because it's this dream of general purpose automation. And large language models are clearly part of keeping that dream alive, right?
Like, to be clear, LLMs are amazing. There's a whole bunch of cool stuff you can do with them. I was reading, actually, I think you just mentioned The Verge. I was reading a great Verge article the other day about Humane, this AI pen. And there's like a very operative paragraph towards the end of this review where the author is like, yeah, the problem with this is like the problem with all AI. I have no idea how it works, so I don't know how to make it work better.
Right. Right.
I have no idea why sometimes I say X and I get the Y result that I want. And sometimes I say X and it says can't connect to server. And sometimes I say X and it says zebras are delicious. And like, I have no understanding.
This is one of the interesting problems, right? Is like, if you go for that sort of like, you know, for your initial round or two of funding, you're going for that general purpose thing. You got to bet heavy on that probabilistic technology. But then if you want to pivot to something with human in the loop, like humans aren't used to using probabilistic tools. Yeah. Like it's weird that for me, like the experience of like I'm wearing a t-shirt that I worked with a human artist to develop for the Autonicast. And I was like across a language barrier, there were challenges, but we were able to do it because we're able to sort of like start with the concept and narrow it down. Yep. The problem trying to do that with Midjourney or with one of these generative things is like, it's like every time you're rolling the dice, you're rolling, right? Yep. And you're never sort of like, it's so hard to deterministically work your way towards what you're.
And it's a new, and like basically similar to how we had to learn how to use search engines, we need to learn how to use those tools. But I think as we learn how to use those tools, the magic will the shine will come off a little bit.
Right. Okay. So I want to talk about Polymath, right? This is your new company. Tell us a little bit about sort of how it came into being.
Yeah. So Starsky, we're fortunate enough to be like very generously covered by the media. And every time we'd get some big post or coverage somewhere, I'd get a bunch of weird emails in our like partners app. And the emails would go something like this, like, hey, seems like you've solved autonomy. We have a weird vehicle that only 4 people in the world use. We have 50 of these vehicles of a global population of 112. We spend $400,000 a year to put people in these vehicles to do some very specific tasks that we care about. If I pay you $10 million, can you automate that for me? And at Starsky, we had to reject all those people. And that's weird. Like if we were building DocuSign and someone was reaching out saying, hey, I don't really want to sign documents. I want to mass autograph images of myself. Can you build an API for that? I'll pay you $10 million. And like any software team will just like, cool. We just pivoted. It's great. Everything that we said that we do, like this is a 5% change and we can do that. The reality in robotics today is that nearly everyone is reinventing nearly every part of the stack from scratch for nearly every application. It's a lot like how software worked before Microsoft, where if you wanted to build a Word document software for lawyers, you needed electrical engineers to design chipsets. And like people are like, oh, we're going to build word processing for lawyers. We need to raise $300 million because we need to build a computer and data centers and this, that, and the other. What we're building at Polymath is we're building a generalized navigation layer that can drive any off-road vehicle from any point in space to any other point in space. And that's it. We're not doing any of the hardware ourselves. We're not doing the app that tells us where to go ourselves. We're not dealing with traffic on public roads. We're literally just building software that does everything from run the drivers on the sensor to know where we are in the world, all the way through, you know, should the throttle be this? Should I apply the brake? Should I turn the steering wheel like this to actually get from one point in space to another? And as a result, we're like deployed on bulldozers and tractors and UTVs. And like we actually are on more different types of vehicles right now than we have people on the team, let alone actual number of robots. And I don't think that's true for any of the big robotaxi organizations.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just want to like break this down for a minute because I think it's just brilliant, right? You have this really tough challenge between like to get funded, you have to say you're going to do it all, yep. right? You can't just be like, oh, I'm going to set up a consultancy that's going to go case by case and build a unique robot for each one. You can't get that funded, right? But on the other hand,
and also those consulting firms tend to make crap because robotics is so hard that even if you have experienced consultants, they'll say, all right, cool. I think this project will take about 800 hours and like 800 times our rate. Cool. That's the price. And then they'll be, you know, a month or two into it. They'll be 100 hours into it and say, yeah, we totally didn't know that you need this. Or this thing doesn't work, or this sensor just got end of life. Instead of 800 hours, it's now going to be 1,400 hours. Now it's going to be 1,800 hours. Now it's going to be 4,000 hours. And along the way, they cut functionality. Along the way, they cut reliability. So almost no one who buys from those consultants like that ends up being happy. And that all goes back to just how hard and stupid the robotics industry is at the moment. And every team that's getting venture funding to go automate tractors or automate port trucks or do whatever basically has to rebuild every interesting paper that's come out and has been relevant in the last 20 years.
So if you think of a robotics, you know, stack for any one of these applications, you've got that sort of base at the bottom, right? And that is where you can generalize. So essentially you're saying, we're just not going to solve the whole thing for you. You have to take
I don't know how to run a mine, you know? I don't know when you should go up the steep hill or the shallow hill.
And this is a really interesting thing about robotics. Toyota has this whole thing about how they won't automate a task until they are completely convinced that a human has totally mastered it. Yeah. And so like I was there in 2019 at Toyota City and they were building this huge new training center. I was like, well, what about all the automation that's coming? And they're like, no, that's why we're doing this. We want to train people because otherwise, like if you haven't mastered it on a human, then what are you automating? Yeah. Why are you automating it, right?
Well, because automation's cool.
And it's because, well, right, exactly. Exactly. And God bless Toyota.
You just throw some machine learning at it and like, you know, everyone will get laid.
Yeah. And they know that like if you put a robot in somewhere because you think it's cool, then it breaks down and you have to fly someone from the other side of the world. Meanwhile, your car factory is burning, you know, ungodly amounts of money all the time.
Millions of dollars every 10 minutes.
Yeah. But like that core understanding of like a human has to be able to do the people who do the job understand how to automate it. Not just understand how, but understand what even you should try to
understand
automate.
The parts of the task that they're mindless for and understand the parts of the task where they actually have to pay a whole lot of attention.
And this is something that startups really struggle with. Like I feel like even you kind of alluded to this earlier, like I have huge respect for Waymo. They're clearly as a team achieving a technological breakthrough. Amazing. They've done an amazing job.
Yeah.
Do they understand, like, are they rooted in the operations of the ride hailing business is a totally separate question.
I mean, I more than once I've tried to order a Waymo in San Francisco and it's been four times the cost of an Uber.
Huh. Interesting.
Right. So yeah. Like, what's the most recent number and how much Waymo has spent? $30 billion?
I don't have it in front of me, but I think the burn is over $2 billion a year.
Yeah. I feel like I once heard a number that was $30 billion in total spent.
Yeah.
Maybe it's 20.
Sounds about right.
So they've spent $20 billion and they've, I don't know, let's say 2,000 inventions, like things that humanity did not know how to do before. They figured out as an organization. They moved human civilization forward by some appreciable amount. But like their matching algorithm for price prediction and quoting me a price is why I used an Uber.
Right. Right. No, I mean, it's and there's so many layers to these problems. And I think the lesson here is that where automation works is where you really understand the problem that you're trying to solve. And frankly, no startup, no technical expert, right? The technical experts like you, you guys are good at what you do. Your customers are good at what they do.
We know how to talk to nerds. We know how to drive stuff from point to point and not hit stuff. However, like going back to that mine example, in many mines, there is a steep path that is short and there is a shallow path that is long. Depending on the prevailing price of bauxite and the prevailing price of fuel, maybe every vehicle should go on the long, shallow path that burns less fuel. Maybe everything should go on the steeper path. That level of optimization is basically unavailable because human drivers are finicky and complain if you yell at them too much and won't just change routes on an hour by hour or day by day or week by week basis. For if you're farming a field, Like, let's say at 2 miles, at 1 mile an hour, you get 95% of the crop per acre. And at 2 miles an hour, you get 80% of the crop per acre. If it's raining in 3 days and it's got, you have 6 days left of farming, any field, any part of the field that you don't farm might rot. So you might suddenly want to be driving 2 or 3 miles an hour. And you might want to make that decision the second the rain forecast comes in with accurate, with effect, with predicted accuracy greater than X percent, and rain starting in, you know, 3 days or whatever some magical period of time is. And human farmers are just don't do that because that's not how humans operate.
Yep. And so you're also, I think it's really important to point out, you're not locked into hardware on the vehicle side. You mentioned, you know, I love it, more we're on more vehicles than we have employees. What makes that possible?
Yeah, so we work with a great set of integrators to add hardware to existing vehicles. We work with a number of OEMs who are handling their own robots altogether. And actually, even better than more robots than employees, the vast majority of our robots, no one on our team has ever seen in person.
Wow.
Like, so a standard thing of robotics is you take some roboticist who is well paid, significantly more than the median income, and you fly them to West Armpit because, like, I don't know, the robot doesn't seem to turn on right now. Can you figure that out? That engineer can't figure it out. Let's throw three more at it. We haven't had to visit most of these because we have hardware integrators who can just focus on being really smart on hardware. Or the OEMs who can be really smart on their own hardware. And we've built infrastructure to be able to remote deploy software because the software on your phone has also been remotely deployed. Like, software can go over the internet. It's bits. It's not atoms.
Absolutely. Yeah. So then this also, like, right, by sort of creating this platform to build on, really, like, now all of a sudden players that are, like, kind of smaller who maybe weren't even thinking about automation just because of that kind of eye-watering upfront, like, cost of doing everything ground up, which is sort of what everyone does. So who's getting into automation that might not otherwise?
I mean, I think, like, the cost to get to a product is dropped by two orders of magnitude. Like, you no longer need, you know, like, I like to poke fun of my friends at Bear Flag Robotics. Self-driving tractor.
Bought by John Deere.
I'm sure
they could take your jokes. Yeah,
very happy to be made fun of in this. You know, $50 million, 5 years, and, you know, an undisclosed number of tractors that are fewer than their employee count at acquisition. And we can make that, 50 people, $50 million, and 5 years. We can make the same sort of thing happen in 5 months with four people with, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in terms of technical capability. So, like, we can allow our customers who are seed funded to outperform, you know, companies who have been bought for hundreds of millions of dollars. We can allow OEMs who, you know, don't have 400 people to throw at automating their vehicles to be right up there against Caterpillar and Komatsu and Deere. We can allow operators who are a little bit more technical than the average to no longer suffer by the whims of their OEMs.
Yeah. And I mean, this is what, like, a maturing industry looks like, right? I mean, if you think about, right, every automaker used to have to make every fastener and bolt, and, you know what I mean? Like, obviously the supply chain started relatively early in the auto industry because it's so complex, but, like, robotics,
it's similar.
Yeah.
And, like, for robots to be real, it looks like this.
Yeah.
Like, no, like the iPhone did not, like, come out of the clouds majestically one day as this great vertically integrated thing that Steve Jobs dreamed up. And honestly, frankly, the Tesla Model 3 didn't either.
Right.
Both of those products came after, you know, decades of people figuring out how to make cars, figuring out how to make phones, and frankly, buying as many components as made sense for either of those products to build, especially in the early days when a Tesla was just a Lotus with some weird guts.
Yeah. So are we seeing similar, like, sort of maturation on the, like, robotics hardware side? Like, is it rationalizing a bit?
Yeah, I don't know. It's been a long time since someone told me they needed to build their own sensors to build autonomy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So on the sensor side,
I don't
remember
the last time I heard someone say that.
Yeah. And a lot of that is, like, sort of the sort of bubble, the tech dividend from the bubble, right? Which is, like, a lot of these companies may not have survived, but they push that technology forward. LiDAR is, like, night and day cheaper,
I mean,
right?
I once heard a conversation between a billion-dollar L4 company and a billion-dollar vendor of things to L4 companies, where the L4 company CEO said to the vendor, "I know your product's better than our in-house thing, but we'll never use it because I have 40 people working on it." Yeah. And that is, those days are gone. Like, those companies are no longer being funded.
Which is unfortunate, because there were a lot of startups who were hoping to slot into some of those spots that, that are also no longer here.
Yes, yes.
I can think of a couple of examples.
There's no longer a world where you get to sell, you know, where a company no longer gets to sell themselves for, you know, $1 billion because they built some particularly interesting tool to a company that's worth $100 billion. But I think what is possible now is companies can get to a real product in the market with millions of dollars raised as opposed to billions.
So,
and that means, like, there's a chance, like, all of the, you know, as much as we can both, you know, be glass half empty on robotics and autonomy and this bad thing's happening, that bad thing's happening, all the fun things, all the good things that we've talked about, that we've thought about for, like, what autonomy might mean for the world, a safer world, a more productive world, a world where it doesn't matter where you live as much, and this, that, and the other, 40 minutes given back to every American commuter. All those things start to become more feasible as these products split into more steps that more different companies help provide parts of.
Right. And critically, each one of those companies then can focus on building an actual business and not boiling the ocean. Yes. Right.
And building their particular part of the stack to be good enough that it actually can be relied on.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I would be remiss. You talked about sort of how earlier about how, you know, sort of regulatory barriers in the AV bubble era was sort of, and continue to be, I think, you know, used as sort of like an excuse for what are really just technological challenges. But at the same time, you can't help but notice Polymath operates off-road. Is that have to do with regulatory, or is that more about the market opportunity?
So on public roads, you need to be, it matters what you do when things break, right? So we were talking about before we started the podcast how crews burnt through a lot of their public goodwill by just like being stopped in the streets. When I was trying to get home and my Uber needed to cross into the opposite lane of traffic to get around them.
And traffic was already bad enough.
Yes. Like, they burnt a lot of goodwill with that.
Yep.
And if you do the same thing on a highway, you know, the likelihood of causing a fatality accident is pretty high. The vehicles that we drive, if everything goes chaotic, we can stop. And stopping is a default safe behavior. And that is a very nice little... That's a nice little get out of jail free card. You can take more risks. You can be less optimized. It's very feasible that we can be on so many different types of machines with the same safety layer across them all when that's what we can do. Now, on the other hand, like, for us to reliably pull over to the side of the road, for us to reliably do things like that, those are products we could add in time. But frankly, there's a lot of people focusing on road. There's a lot of off-road vehicles that no one's doing a great job of chasing. And that's kind of what we're going to focus on.
Yeah. And a lot of those are, you know, vehicles that earn a lot of money. I mean, whether it's, you know, mining or timber or agriculture or things like that.
Some of the large folks who sell into mining are charging $1 million per vehicle per vehicle setup fees, $250,000 or sometimes even $1 million per year to operate the thing. They're putting a shipping container with 3 to 5 engineers working around the clock on site. And overall, to get into these systems, you're paying a minimum of $20 to $100 million. To big OEMs who are not all that nice to you once you bought them. I heard fourth hand story of one of the large companies of those systems going to one of the OEMs and saying, "We're your largest customer for this. You need to fix this problem for us." And the OEM saying, "We do more money. We do more business in our apparel sales than you pay us. So, go get bent."
Yeah.
Wow. That's a good industry to serve.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So what part of this, you know, sort of looking forward now, like, where do you see sort of the biggest opportunities for the kind of automation that you're enabling?
So what I'm really excited about is the fact that I think it's going to be in all of these markets at the same time. But like, that's not to say it's going to be 1,000 customers. So most of these off-highway industries are functionally private equity businesses. Like, the reason why BHP at its core has a really low cost of capital for buying a junior mine for $2 billion and then spending $3 billion to turn into an $8 billion asset. That's like actually what they're really good at. Yep. Now, that $8 billion asset, once they own it, makes a 5 to 20% margin a year after they hire 5,000 people. If instead they only have to hire 50 people, if instead they only need to go hire some, you know, McKinsey or Deloitte or whoever to spin up a bunch of software to operate on that site, suddenly you're buying a $2 billion asset. You're spending $500 million, mostly on like vehicle hardware. And now you have an asset that's spitting out a 50% margin. Whoever does that first in mining is going to be able to buy all their competitors before their competitors even know it's happening. Whoever does that first in ag is going to consolidate massive farms relatively quickly. Every single one of these industries is going to be disrupted in relatively short order. And it's just going to be the most innovative in them will beat everyone else before the dinosaurs know that the asteroid was in the sky or the meteor was in the sky.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, one of the things, you know, talking about the EV business and some of the challenges there is like, you know, that I've been trying to like get out there is like, you know, scaling resource extraction is not like manufacturing, yeah. Right? You can take a factory and sort of put it almost anywhere in the world. And, you know, maybe the electrical hookups are different. The labor laws are a little different, you know, different suppliers, right? Locally, things like that. But like localization, it's the core thing. Whereas every single mine is its own beast, right? The kinds of ore and the veins and the techniques, and there's just so much variety. Scaling that up to meet the demands.
And hiring and getting 5,000 people to be willing to go to some weird, random place.
Remote.
That's like 1,000 miles away from any city center.
Yep.
And like building an airport to fly them in and out.
Yep.
And doing all these things. Like it just takes time. Yep. You can't build an airport in a weekend.
And increasingly, there's a lot more like, you know, scrutiny of like working conditions and things like that, you know, and so there's a situation where all of a sudden, like, you know, automation and having a highly automated facility, like, you're not gonna have kids running around there, you know. It's depressing that's the state of
mining.
And
like the screwed up thing is like the robots available in mines today are so expensive that they are not competitive against kids, and the reason for that is just kind of sloppy robotics.
Yeah.
You build good robots, suddenly it is no longer economical to have child labor. That's a good future for my perspective, at least. Yeah. I'd like to disincentivize child labor. Yeah. Weird hot take.
Saving the spicy stuff for last. Well, Stefan, this, as usual, this has been like a really, really fun conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you.